Coming up, do you ever feel that the only way to really make it as an entrepreneur right now is to build a hot mobile app? Well, wait till you hear this founder's story and how she did it. Also, how would you launch an ice cream truck business if you didn't even have an ice cream truck? The way today's guest did it will inspire you to think more creatively. And, well, do you ever get so depressed that you slept for days? Well, I'm gonna see if I can get today's guest to talk about that experience and how she got out of it and how you can too. So, all that and so much more coming up, so stay tuned. Before we get started, I want to congratulate Mixergy fan Carlos Solorio, who co-founded Arden Reed while listening to my interviews, the way you're about to listen to this program. Can you imagine the pride he feels every time someone goes to ardenreed.com and buys a custom-made suit or shirt? I just 5 minutes ago bought a suit and shirt there. Mixergy is made for doers of the world like Carlos and you. And this whole shebang here is sponsored by Grasshopper. Do you need a single phone number that comes with multiple extensions so anyone in your company can be reached no matter where they are? Well, go to grasshopper.com already. It's the complete virtual phone system that entrepreneurs love. And it's sponsored by Walker Corporate Law. Do you need a lawyer who actually understands the startup world? How about that? Instead of one that just figures that anything online is beyond him. Scott Edward Walker is a part of the startup community, which is why I recommend when you need a lawyer, you go to walkercorporatelaw.com. Now let's get started with the program. Hey there, freedom fighters. My name is Andrew Warner. I'm the founder of Mixergy.com, home of the ambitious upstart. How does an entrepreneur snag clients? Did I say that clearly? Snag. I always admire professional interviewers and how they get every word pronounced perfectly. I don't on the first shot, so I'll say it again. How does an entrepreneur snag clients like Universal Music, Adidas, Whole Foods, J. Crew, the U.S. Census Bureau, the W Hotel, Playboy, and Tom Cruise? Well, Felicia, there, I'm not a professional interviewer, huh? But I'm a professional entrepreneur, and I know the kind of questions that we entrepreneurs need the answers to. So I'll continue here with my bad introduction and my great questions. Felicia Hatcher is the founder of Feverish Ice Cream, a gourmet popsicle and ice cream catering company. I invited her here to tell us about how she launched and grew the business and how she attracted such an impressive list of customers. Felicia, welcome.
Thank you, Andrew. I'm excited.
Me too. So, you had a client. I forget about Tom Cruise and the Census Bureau and all those big name clients. You had a client who called you from the hospital, and he said what?
He called from the hospital, and at first I thought it was a joke. He's like, hey, I'm getting ready to be discharged from Jackson Hospital, which is one of the hospitals in Miami, right out of
downtown.
And I've been in the hospital for a lung transplant and a heart transplant, and I'm coming to get ice cream from you. Like, what time do you close? And it was like a Saturday. It was like a late Saturday afternoon, so I'm just like, yeah, I'm going to be here for, you know, maybe about 30 more minutes. But if I know you're coming, I'll wait a little bit longer. And he's like, no, I'm coming. Like, I just got discharged from the hospital. So I'm like, okay. And I'm thinking someone is like kidding for me just because of the story he was telling me. And, you know, 20 minutes later, this guy shows up with his, you know, his wife and his sister and, you know, with the hospital bracelet and everything. And he's like, I saw you on TV. It was like one of the reruns from the Cooking Channel. And I was so touched by your story. And the first thing that I wanted to do as I just got a heart transplant and a lung transplant and been in the hospital for 3 weeks is come meet you in person and try some of your ice cream. And I was so blown away, you know, from everything. Yes, everything that we've been able to accomplish with our company, but I don't think anything trumps that experience of, you know, someone was literally on their deathbed and the first thing that they wanted to do, you know, instead of meeting family is to come meet me and come get some of our ice cream.
And this is not because he ate your ice cream before and had a craving for it in the hospital, but because he knew you by reputation.
Uh-huh.
All right. I got to find out how you built up that reputation too, because if that's what's getting customers in the door, I want to hear about that too. going back, actually, before we even go back, what size revenue are you guys doing today with all this excitement and all this big reputation that you've built?
Well, we're a private company, so I would rather not disclose that right now. But from, you know, as far as ice cream companies and the type of company that we're doing pretty well.
Can you give us a ballpark? Are you over $1 million a year yet?
We're not quite over $1 million, but okay. We're good.
All right. How about this? If you won't give me the numbers, and I knew going into the interview that you were going to check and you might not come in with revenue numbers. If you can't give us revenue numbers, how about the number of, I guess it was popsicles that you sold to Google for one of their conventions? Uh-huh. How many did Google buy?
That's coming up. They're going to do about 10,000 popsicles for the Republican National Convention.
So they just want to give your popsicles out to the Republicans at their convention.
Correct. Okay. So we're branding it. We're doing some custom stuff for them. Custom message on the stick, custom message on the wrapper. Wrapping one of our trucks with their whatever they're going to decide to put on the truck. And then, you know, for 4 days of nonstop popsicle slinging at the Republican National Convention.
What I heard from Jeremy Weiss, our producer, is that you used to work for the WNBA, and there was one time when you went to work from 8 to 4 p.m., you were just at meetings at work.
Yeah.
Can you tell us about that experience, about working at a job? I know you're very entrepreneurial. What was it like for you to work at a job with that fear, with that entrepreneurial spirit?
Well, it wasn't just one day. That was kind of like an almost everyday occurrence.
Oh, every day, 8 to 4, lots of meetings, nothing getting done.
You know, it was really hard because I started my first business when I was in college, at 19 years old. So I always had that in me. And you know, you major in something, so you feel like you have to work in that field too. And so that's why I kind of put everything off for about 5 years and worked in corporate America. You know, I played basketball all throughout my life, so I just imagined that working for the WNBA and even being on the front office executive team was just like a dream come true. And, you know, within the first month, I started to find that it was more of a nightmare come true. I'm a different kind of person. I love being outside. I love the excitement of being able to meet people and interact with people. And I didn't get that from my job there. You know, I was sharing a cubicle with two other people and being in meetings all day long. And then also dealing with the unique corporate environment there was just something that was, it kind of ate at me every single day. Like, I would tell my husband every night, I'm like, I feel like this job is literally making me sick. Like, I need to get out of here. And it's not just because of the weather.
That job that you worked back, the first business, I should say, that you launched, was that the one where you were coaching high schoolers on how to get into college?
Yes, absolutely. It was called Urban Excellence. I started it with a friend of mine, James Taylor, and we both had very unique backgrounds growing up, and we both won full scholarships in very unique ways. I ended up winning about $120,000 in scholarships and grants as a C student in high school. I had horrible grades in high school. But it was kind of like my first lesson in marketing myself. And that's what I wanted to share with high school students and their parents. You know, a lot of them, hey, they feel like they're a walking GPA, or because something has happened in their life, they can't go on to college, they can't start a business, they can't achieve something great. And the business was really created to show them how to do that, but then also work with colleges and universities and organizations to help them build better college prep programs.
What was the number one most effective tip that you shared with your customers?
Number one is joining as many clubs as you can to increase your chances. So it's really all about increasing your opportunities and even creating the opportunities for yourselves. And another thing is knowing when to quit some of those opportunities too. You know, you have a lot of high school kids who stay on the basketball team for all 4 years, but have no chance of ever making it to play college basketball or for the NBA or the NFL or whatever. So knowing when to quit and put your eggs in another basket, like joining FBLA because they give away tons of scholarships and their network is huge, or joining SECME, which is like a STEM organization that here in South Florida, they give away like 25 full scholarships. And it's nearly, you're not going to get as beat up as you would playing football or basketball.
So how'd you get clients? You were 19 years old. You were still in school. How did you get customers to come and sign up?
Well, in the very beginning, even before starting the company, you know, sometimes our moms are our biggest cheerleaders, right? So my mom was the one who was telling all her friends my story. Hey, you know, Felicia just won all this money. And that's actually where the clients started to come. So before I even realized that that was a client, they were kind of coming to me and wanting advice. And my mom was the first push, like, hey, you know, you can turn this into a business. Like, you need to charge people. You're spending a lot of time. So that's really where my first initial clients came
Your
from.
Your mom put, now most mothers, I think, would feel that they have to tell their kids to share the knowledge, to just teach, to not charge. To, why did your mother feel that it was important for you to start charging for this?
My mom, she just has always pushed me. You know, she was one of those moms that I remember being a kid and cutting up my clothes and trying to sew them back together because I couldn't afford like the new Nike stuff or whatever. And instead of, you know, fussing at me, the next day she bought me like a little pink sewing machine and say, hey, if you're going to cut up clothes, you might as well, you know, get some help behind it. Instead of, you know, a lot of parents push their kids away into what they imagine success should be for them. So she saw that I was spending a lot of time doing this and she saw that I really was passionate about it. And she's like, hey, this could be a business for you. Instead of going to work for McDonald's or, you know, Target or whatever, see if this will work as a business for you and you can make money off of it. And, you know,
was she very entrepreneurial? Did she keep suggesting entrepreneurial ideas to you?
Yes and no. My mom's an educator. She's a college professor. So she wanted my brother and I to both be teachers. Okay. But then have a side business. Like that was always her
and have equation. A side business. Why a side business?
Cause she has her hand in a lot of different things, you know, aside from being a teacher, she does a lot. So I think she really understood the importance of us wanting to follow our passion, and she wanted us to have that something to fall back on, I think, like a lot of parents do, but then also understood that, you know, this is a way that we're going to be able to build wealth for our family, and it's not going to necessarily be working for someone else. You're going to have something else.
Okay. And when it was time for you to reach outside of the people who just came to you or came to you through your mom, how'd you find new clients?
A lot of it was cold calling.
You would cold call?
Oh, yeah, I did. I don't do it as much because I think I've gotten a little bit more of a fear about it, which is kind of awkward that I went backwards like that. But I didn't know anything about starting a business. Like I didn't do the lemonade stand or anything when I was a kid. I sold Girl Scout cookies and a lot of that was just knocking on doors. So kind of, I guess, harnessing that and like, all right, I'm going through this book. I want to work with this organization, that organization. I don't know any of these people. Let me just pick up the phone. And in the very beginning, I would pick up the phone and offer my services for free just to kind of get my foot in the door. And then from there, I would do more cold calling. Like it was almost a part of like, you know, my daily schedule pretty much to cold call and just ask organizations, hey, can I send you over some information? Hey, can I drop by? Let's talk.
How did you even know that the organizations would be the places where you can find your clients? Most, I think, young entrepreneurs would think, I have to go after clients one at a time. They might think advertising is a way of reaching broadly, but they wouldn't even consider organizations as the place to turn to. How did you know that was the way to go?
Well, I participated in a lot of youth organizations when I was a kid, so I kind of knew how they worked from a participant standpoint. But then I knew that, hey, I didn't want to, you know, part of my business was sitting down one-on-one with parents and their kids, and that took up a lot of time and didn't make the most money. So I'm like, hey, let me go to a place where I could, for an hour or for a week, talk to, you know, anywhere from 10 kids to a few hundred kids and still be able to make the same impact. So I knew organizations like the YMCA, or I knew churches that had the audience already there and they were already a captive audience. Let me just figure out ways to partner with them.
I see. Well, here's the part where I think I do better than a regular interviewer on TV. They may have the polish and can get people's names right and get their intros right on the first shot. But what they never have done is make a cold call. I remember trying to make a cold call and just being nervous about it and second guessing myself as an entrepreneur, second guessing myself as a winner if I was too hesitant to make a phone call. And I had to battle with myself. And what eventually helped me win and make that phone call is this feeling of inferiority, this feeling of nothing's going to go right unless you could overcome this one thing and make this phone call. Because if you can't do that, how are you going to ask for loans? How are you going to build a business? What did you do to overcome that? That wasn't an easy thing to just do, pick up the phone and cold call.
You know, back then I didn't know any better. Like, that's the honest truth. I didn't know any other way to get a customer. You know, Facebook wasn't around then, you know, or LinkedIn.
So why didn't you just say, hey, you know what, when I'm older, I'll have these contacts and I'll be able to do it. Or when I'm more polished or when the business is more advanced, then I can make a phone call and really get people to listen to me. Why did you push yourself to make that call? Or did you have to?
Honestly, I didn't know any better, and I didn't know I had any other choice. I didn't know there was any other way to get a client. Like, I didn't really understand networking events or reaching out to my dad, who was a business owner, to see if he knew someone to recommend me. I didn't know that. All I knew was that I was going through the yellow pages and I saw the name of these organizations, or I would pick up a magazine and I saw an organization that did something remotely like I wanted to do, and I would pick up the phone and call. Like, you know, over the years, I got a little bit more uneasy about making cold calls. And with
because
that, I don't know. I think, you know, I think a lot of my friends, they said, hey, if I knew now what I knew back then, I probably wouldn't have done it. And I think it was the same way with cold calling. So now that I know the process and you kind of go through, you know, lots of rounds of rejection, you kind of change course a little bit. And I've, you know, over the years, what I've started to do to kind of get myself into it is I would wait until like super early in the morning, like 7 o'clock in the morning, or wait until like 6 o'clock at night if it was a phone call that I was afraid to make. And I would be able to do it on their voicemail and practice like over and over again, hit the star button and then redo it if I up. And then I always felt that it kind of put them in the position to call me back. And then, I don't know, it was just a weird thought of mine.
I get it.
A whole lot. And then, you know, I would send them an email through like Mad Mimi or something like that, where I can track to see if they've opened it. And then if they open the email, I'm like, all right, they kind of are familiar with me. Then I can pick up the phone and call, and I don't have to give my whole spiel and risk them hanging up on me. So I all kind of do those little things to kind of help psych us up a little bit.
You know, we're going to do a course for Mixergy Premium about these kinds of entrepreneurial sales tools, like what you call, Mad Mimi?
Yeah, it's kind of like Constant Contact. There's a ton of them, but I love Mad Mimi. It's kind of quirky.
Okay. And you just wanted to know, did they even read my email before I called them up? Because if they didn't read my email, then I'm going to have a tougher time making the sale and they won't be as warm to me. I want to know all those different tools. Anyway, we'll get to that at some other point at MixergyPremium.com. For now, moving on with your story, you started in 19, that previous business. At 25, you came up with this creative idea that became your current business. What was the original idea? Where did it come from?
The original idea, I was leaving a party and we were talking about ice cream. It was super hot. It's always hot in Florida. And I walk outside of this party and an ice cream truck starts rolling by. And you kind of turn into a kid anytime you hear that music, and that's exactly what I did. So I start chasing after this ice cream truck, forgetting that I'm in heels, and I fall down flat on my face chasing after this ice cream truck. And as embarrassing as it was, that's kind of when the light bulbs went off for me. One light bulb, I'm way too excited for an ice cream truck. I think it's like 22 or 23 at the time. And then why hasn't anyone come up with like a cooler way for adults to enjoy ice cream so they don't have to chase after an ice cream? And I...
No, go on. I'll follow up in a moment.
I toyed around with the idea for a while. I was doing a lot of research, found some really cool companies that were kind of doing the same thing. And just kept throwing ideas around for probably about 2 or 3 years. I mean, it was just this ratted up notebook that I would constantly put things in. And the idea that I came up with was, hey, I wanted to do this really cool ice cream truck, pimp it out, you know, from the inside and out, and make it almost like a mobile listening lounge, but it was an ice cream truck. So people can actually come inside the ice cream truck and sit down and eat ice cream and listen to music. And then get like record labels to like pay me to listen to get people to listen to their music. It was just a really weird idea. Didn't know if it was going to go anywhere, but I wasn't going to let it go until I eventually tried it. And you know, as fate had it, you know, my program was canceled working for Nintendo. So it was kind of like that push to, hey, why not? You know, why not try this crazy idea?
What other ideas? This was when you worked for Nintendo as a mobile marketing tour manager from 2008 to 2009. What other ideas did you write down in that notebook of yours?
Well, with what we were doing, it was all about creating the experience. So like a lot of corporations, they were moving money away from traditional advertising, you know, newspapers, print, TV commercials, more to experience marketing. And that's what we were really doing.
That's what you were doing at Nintendo.
Correct.
See. So that's why you weren't thinking, let's just sell ice cream. You were thinking, I want to sell an experience, because companies were already looking to experiences as marketing mechanisms.
Right, exactly. And I was just trying to figure out, like, how can I do what the big boys are doing without the big boy budget, of course, being able to scale it down and create an experience with ice cream.
And were your ideas always to sell to corporations like Nintendo, or did you think, I'm just going to drive this down the street and make sales one-on-one?
It was never the drive down the street. Because I was just like, I don't want to be a neighborhood ice cream truck. And then I don't want to compete with them either. And I don't want people from high school or college to be like, oh my God, that's what Felicia did with her life. She's driving an ice cream truck. I really wanted to go after music companies. Like, that was my ideal client. As far as the big clients, that was really, I wanted to go after every single one of them. I wanted all of them to constantly send me their music and pay me to hand out their music with ice cream. Like, that was the original idea. So like the client roster that we had now, I didn't really envision any of them being part of the equation. It was always just music companies.
I see. You know, that's one of the things that I admire about you, and reading the research that I have on you and also listening to your story here. You never think, how can I get a customer one at a time? You're always thinking bigger than that. How do I partner up with music companies who have lots of clients or lots of attendees at their events? Or going back in time, how do I partner with local organizations who have the students who will eventually end up buying from me? I love that way of thinking.
Well, I mean, that's what the big companies do. You know, sales happen one client at a time, but how can they constantly get the biggest bang for their buck, while they're doing their marketing efforts? So with working for Nintendo and doing these activations, we were always going to big fairs and festivals. Or if we, you know, when we did the product launch for the Nintendo Wii Fit, it was in Times Square, you know, not going down to the local mall. It was in the biggest impact you can get in pretty much in New York. So they're always looking at that kind of impact. And so we wanted to be able to have that kind of impact, but still be able to have, you know, incremental impact within that event and within that experience as well.
You know what? I'm glad that you're talking about this, because I want to have a complete picture of what it's like to work for another company. It's very easy for me to say, my audience is entrepreneurs. We got to rag on the big companies that you work for and promote the excitement of being an entrepreneur. In fact, let's get rid of all the depression talk and only talk about the upside of entrepreneurship. But we have to acknowledge that, yes, it's frustrating to be in meetings from 8 to 4 p.m. and have nothing happen. That is part of working for a big corporation. But another part is your eyes are open to these bigger opportunities. They don't look at one customer at a time the way a young entrepreneur might. They think of, how do we get into Times Square? How do we partner with people who have massive audiences and with events that have big exposure? And that seems to me, tell me if I'm wrong, that's one of the lessons that you got from working for these big corporations that helped you with your businesses.
Oh, yeah. That was a huge lesson. As much as I hated some of the jobs that I worked in, I was definitely a sponge, and everything that I could learn, I did, and I took it with me, you know, from building better presentations to pitch to clients, working with advertising agencies and bringing advertising agencies on, and how that whole process of an RFP works. So then the whole marketing aspect of it, and definitely the strategic partnerships, you know. Big companies maintain and grow to be bigger companies because of the strategic partnerships that they're able to build. Hey, you have something that I want. Hey, you have something I want. Let's bring it together and have a big impact together. That's what they're all about. That's always been my biggest takeaway.
The great thing about Mixergy is we don't have to spend years working from 8 to 4 p.m. meetings that go nowhere and have those boring parts of our lives that we feel like will make us actually sick. We can just watch you for about an hour and learn all the best parts and leave the rest behind.
Well, as an entrepreneur, it's no longer like 9 to 4. It's like 12 midnight to 12 the next morning. So It's an interesting exchange, right? But at least you're doing the things that you want to do, and you can say no to the things that you want to say no to.
What did you say no to, by the way, as an entrepreneur that you were proud to be able to turn away?
Meetings about meetings. I don't do a lot of meetings, believe it or not. Definitely do a lot of phone calls, but if face-to-face meetings don't need to happen because of, I mean, with technology, like, hey, we've talked on Skype and through the telephone and we're able to get everything that we need done. So I just hate to waste that time when it can be allocated towards other things.
I said in our intro that you didn't have a truck when you got your first client.
Yeah.
How do you get a client for an ice cream truck business when you don't have a truck? What did you do to get that client?
Well, I, again, like how I was telling you, I was kind of just in the concept phase and kind of molding that. And I wasn't really, we're always like, hey, one day I'm going to start this. So I was kind of in that one day I'm going to start this, not really being, not really at the time where I wanted to launch it or thought it was a viable idea to launch it, especially since I didn't have a truck or a cart. And that was when MySpace was like the thing at the time. So I had my personal MySpace page, but then I started to build this MySpace page for my company.
And the one that didn't really exist yet. There were no incorporation papers, nothing.
Nothing. Okay. Nothing at all. And I had a friend of mine who was like a graphic designer kind of do this mock-up of this truck that I wanted to buy. And so he just kind of did the graphics of what I had in mind on this truck. And that's the picture that I put up on MySpace. And I did MySpace. And then I just got like some email from some website called mypartyplanner.com. So I put the same thing up on there. And within maybe a few weeks, I got a call from a company called Tyco, which is a pretty big company. They found us online and they wanted us to do catering for their employee appreciation party. And I'm like, oh, sure. Yeah, we can make it happen, right? And I got off the phone and I'm telling my husband and he like goes ballistic. He's like, how do you agree to something? How are we going to make that happen? We don't have anything. We're not incorporated yet. Like, we don't even have ice cream. Like, how are we going to make that happen? And I'm like, okay, I have to figure something out. So what we did was we bought two carts off of Craigslist, the luxury shopping site Craigslist, right? And really scrappy because at that time I was just living off of my savings, trying to figure out what I was going to do, but living off the savings. So bought these two carts off of Craigslist, and then I'm like, okay, they look like crap, and I got to do something with them because it doesn't look nearly as what it's supposed to look like. And I still don't have a truck, so like, how am I going to make this happen? And so I started decorating these carts. The event wasn't until December, so we had a little bit of time. Started decorating these carts with my hand, went to Home Depot, got like these vinyl stickers that are really supposed to go on your wall, but I put them on an ice cream truck, got spray paint and spray painted these carts. And they looked okay to me, but when we took them out to our first few like vending events, people absolutely loved them. And did the same thing with a Chevy P30 truck that we bought as well. Is we, put the paint on the outside, decals all over the place, skateboards and paint splats and stuff like that, and painted the inside. Bought a bunch of like little, came up across like the back to school clearance at Target, and really a lot of colorful chairs like that we were able to throw inside the truck. A friend of mine was getting rid of a freezer, so we got a freezer for free. Like, it was kind of like fate just kind of constantly happened along the way to make this happen in time for their event.
Was it the Tyco event where your ice cream truck couldn't actually make it to the event?
So a few days before their event, the truck started acting up. Like, we were driving it around to like the skate parks and stuff and just still constantly kind of testing it out, trying to figure out if it was something that was going to work. And probably about 4 or 5 days before their event, the truck just like would not go the distance at all. Like, I'd get to the stop sign and it would cut off. And we'd already gotten a deposit from them, so we had to make the event happen. So we actually towed the truck to their event. And we're like, all right, we know this truck can drive short distances, but it can't drive long distances. So we had the tow truck like drop us off like a block away from their office so we could drive it in. And we're driving and everything is fine until like a delivery truck would kind of like block us from the right turn that we needed to make. We were like literally a few feet from where we needed to go. So we had to go past the stop sign. And as we go past the stop sign, the truck stops, not turn back on, nothing. And of course, that's when the client comes out and they're wondering what's going on. And we're trying to work as hard as we can to fix it. And we finally had to tell the client, like, yo, the truck is not starting and it will not start back up. And we were so embarrassed. We thought they were going to like fire us right away. And like the owner of the company and my husband, the owner of the company helped push the truck to where it needed to be. And we served the clients like right there. And we were just like, we're never going to get called ever again. They've been a client ever since. And they recommended us like tenfold over and over again.
This is Tyco, very professional operation. I think they were part of a conglomerate at the time.
So they were.
Yeah, big security company. They still feel, even after pushing your truck, hey, you know what? We're going to have this woman back. We're going to hire this truck again. And you've done holiday parties for them, employee appreciation days, that kind of stuff.
Yeah, it's been funny. I mean, a lot of the employees, every time we go there, they'll remind us of it. They'll laugh. You know, it's something you can laugh about, but we weren't back.
Did you doubt yourself at that moment? Did you say to yourself, hey, you know what? Maybe this just isn't for me. I'm not cut out for this. Any of those things?
Yes.
Like, can you talk about that? What's some of the self-talk that you had going on at the time?
It was a horrible idea. You know, I can't survive like the next 10 minutes. It was definitely really embarrassing. It was definitely one of those things where, you know, we bootstrapped like crazy in the beginning. And, you know, when you kind of get everything that you feel is starting to roll into place, like, hey, the truck is painted. It's rolling. You know, we did an event and people liked the ice cream. They liked the concept. And we're like, okay. So we did everything to perfect as much as we could for their event because that was a big milestone for us. And for the truck to like stop right then and there, that's when I wanted to stop at the same time because I'm just like, this is embarrassing. This is never going to work. You know, how are we ever going to recover from this? You know, I'm sure that they'll never hire us again. And I'm sure they'll tell everyone like, hey, this girl brought this junky ice truck and it didn't even work and it broke down right in front of our office. But they did none of that. You know, probably because, you know, hey, they're owners of companies. So at one point they were probably in those same shoes as well.
I see. You know what? I had some negative thought in the beginning of this interview where it wasn't so much about the way that I introed and stepped over my own lines. There was one point where your connection was flaking out on us and you probably didn't notice it, but I did because obviously I catch it after it gets across the internet. And I thought, what am I even doing? It's been years I've been doing these interviews and I still can't even get the technology to cooperate with me. And the only reason I kept going is it'd be awkward when we schedule an hour long interview for me to stop. And there have been times in the past where that same thing has kept me going. And if not that, then at the end of the interview, I feel bad, but I have another interview coming up in a half hour or another one the next day, and I have to keep going. What gets you to keep going when you don't have to do another client afterwards? You don't have to anything.
I mean, I think I've definitely had a lot of those experiences over the years. And I probably have a lot of mini ones and sometimes big ones every single day. My husband, who is my business partner, is really the person that keeps me going every single day. You know, I can vent to him like I can't really vent to anyone else. But then also, I think, you know, having a business where there's a lot of tangible assets, you know, I can go outside of our office and I see one of the ice cream carts and I'm like, hey, you know, I can't stop this business today because what the hell am I going to do with all this equipment? I mean, it's funny, it's quirky, but I remember trying to start a PR firm at one point right after I left the WNBA, and it was a service business. So, and I was working from home, so at any time I could have quit, and I ended up quitting because there was nothing really for me to kind of hold on to, if that makes sense, where Feverish is completely different. So that, you know, that helped as well. And then every time I go on my computer, everything reminds me about my business. So if I wanted to quit, it would never be a simple process. And I think just kind of thinking about the process of, I'll have to liquidate this, I'll have to, the kids program, that we're not going to be able to supply popsicles for them anymore. And I think that small time to just kind of think about what you'll have to do in order to quit kind of put you back into focus of keeping going.
I see. Yeah. So, right. You have the truck. It's more difficult to sell the truck than it is to keep going today. So I'll keep going today. You have the organization where you help kids go to school. You teach them about business. Well, if you quit, then they're not going to continue. I never thought of that as helping others as a way of continuing to work when you don't feel like it. You were at a Miami Beach fashion show. Your company was. How'd you guys get to be a part of that?
That event, we actually just rode up to it, honestly. In the beginning, when we were trying to kind of build our company and build our brand, we knew a lot of the things that we didn't want to do, and that's a lot of the things that the traditional ice cream truck companies were doing. We knew that, hey, we wanted to be, when people thought of our company or thought of desserts at an event, they would remember us because they saw us at a similar event. We didn't know how to get into those events at the beginning because it was in such an early stage. So the only thing that we knew, just like, you know, when I was 19 and cold calling, was, hey, let's just show up and let's be at these events and have people start seeing us at these events and seeing us in this light and start aligning us with these lifestyle and these fashion brands. And that's what we did. And we would just roll up, you know, mostly at night to like nightclubs and fashion events and parties and just be posted up outside. And this is like pre-gourmet food truck. So, you know, so people, it was something that was kind of new to people and something that people thought was really cool. Like, oh my God, I've never seen an ice cream truck or an ice cream cart parked outside of a fashion show or a nightclub before. And it's not the sketchy guy that, you know, sketchy ice cream truck that people think are selling drugs. Like, they're selling real ice cream. And really started to work in our favor because then people that were at that event that were planning other events were like, hey, I want to have that ice cream truck at our fashion show event too. And this time they were paying us to be there instead of us just kind of posting up and selling ice cream. So
I see. But you did give away some free popsicles, I guess, when you got there, and then you sold others.
We give away ice cream because we were like, we don't want to get kicked out of this parking space, especially if we found something good. We don't want to get kicked out of this event because we definitely don't have permits to be on the beach. So we would give out a few, and then, you know, then we would start selling. So that was really the way we promoted it. I remember showing up to like vintage craft fair, and it was just tons of like hipsters, and this is like our crowd. And like, all right, I'm just gonna show up, and I'm gonna give away 50 bars, and then it worked for us. So like, we gave away the ice cream. We didn't really sell a lot after that, but every single year from that, they've invited us back, and those were like one of our top grossing vending events.
South Beach, you mentioned you didn't have a permit. You could get fined $4,000 if you don't have a permit and you're still vending. Did you just do it anyway? You figured, hey, if we give out ice cream, you're nodding. Yes.
Anyways, because we were just like, hey, we're young enough as far as a company that we're just going to take the chance. And you have to, you know, so it's either one of those things where you ask for permission or you ask for forgiveness. And so we're just like, hey, we'll see what happens. You know, I know a lot of food trucks in New York, they just kind of chalk up the fees as monthly rent. So that's kind of how we looked at it. Like, hey, we want to be in here. It's a small barrier, but it's also at night. So they may not be, you know, as strict because whatever, they're off work. So it really ended up working for us.
So I mentioned that list of clients that you had. How did you get them? How do you get the W Hotel? How do you get Playboy? How do you get J. Crew? How do you even know who to call at those companies, let alone convince them to buy from you?
A lot of it, a very small combination of it is actual cold calling. But the bigger is actually a domino effect at the fashion show in the very beginning.
Sorry, the connection did that funny thing again. You're saying a lot of them were cold calls. Some of them actually were cold call, but a lot is.
But a lot of it, they're actually contacting us.
And because you're at those events like the fashion show, you go where they are, you put on an impression that you show that you belong there. You're a brand that needs to be there, and they want to be a part of what you're building.
See the impact of it, and they see that it will fit really well into their image of their event or their design of their event or the objective of their event. So that has really helped us a lot. we blog a lot and we send out a lot of pictures. I'm a picture fanatic, and I recommend any entrepreneur that's selling a product to definitely be, especially, you know, from the experience standpoint. So when we're at events, I'm shooting a few hundred pictures a day, and I'm tweeting about them in real time for our clients so that they, if they're not there, they still get to see things are going well. But then they're also retweeting for us from their websites as well. I'm sorry, from their accounts that have thousands or millions.
I see.
Helped us. But, you know, I can send a proposal to a client all day long and tell them how great we are. But a picture or a video of people experiencing it and having a great time with the product, it sells itself. And it really, it's easier for them to visualize it when they can actually see the experience happening in front of their face.
When you cold call, how do you know who to cold call and what to say?
I mean, from working in marketing, I have kind of learned how that whole game works. So I usually start with the marketing manager. A lot of companies outsource their work to advertising agencies or marketing firms or experiential marketing firms. So that's something that, hey, I do my research on AdAge or Brandweek or any of the other websites to kind of figure out, all right, who has this contract? And that's usually where we start before we start with the actual company. But we do a combination of both. Like, where it's so funny, I was talking to my husband, we're getting ready to do an event for West Elm, who's owned by William and Sonoma. I cold called them about a year ago when they first came out with like these little mini popsicle makers that you can make your own popsicles at home. We wanted to do something with the popsicle maker, and we're getting ready to do a big ice cream giveaway for them next month.
So a year and a month about is how long it takes.
Right. And we never heard back from her through that whole time until maybe about a month and a half ago. She called, and I was just like, I'm looking, I'm like, Derek, this is the lady that I cold called a month ago. So I don't know if she's like, all right, I'm going to call them later or what happened from that. But it was, you know, it's still pretty cool to see that it does happen.
So what I'm learning from that is, first of all, if you don't get the response right away, it doesn't mean you failed. It's not nearly an indication that you're not even on the right track. Sometimes it takes some time. The other thing is, you want to sell to a company, you often don't go directly to the company. You want to go to the company that they hired to work with organizations like yours. But once you do get to them, how do you convince them to go with your popsicles as opposed to the what feels like bajillion other options for what they could have at the event? How do you say, we are the ones that you want?
Well, a lot of it is, we're painting the picture for them. So a lot of times when they're looking for an ice cream company, sometimes they're just literally just looking for ice cream, or the thought in their mind of what a traditional ice cream truck or it looks like. So much more. The biggest part of what we do is we can customize to fit your brand, whatever you're trying to do, whether it's a custom message on a stick, whether it's some social media that you would want us to do for you in addition. So we're constantly adding value above what any other ice cream company here in South Florida and a lot across the country are able to add.
How'd you know that that's what they cared about? I wouldn't have guessed that they would care about putting someone's face on the wrapping, that they would care about putting someone's name on the stick. How did you know that would be so important that they'd sign up?
If you pay attention when you go to events, you'll see that it is something that they care about. So if you go to an event and you get a free drink, you're usually getting a branded napkin, or maybe the cup is branded, or they definitely have some sort of signage around at the event. So all of those elements, somewhere along the way, some company has charged them to brand those elements. So that's what we do too. Like, hey, let's take it a step further. Branded pens are over and done with. Branded napkins, yeah, they're cool. We'll take those. But let's bring the experience further. So just like when I give anyone advice, I'm like, hey, when you're starting a food truck, if you're starting any kind of business and you're working with a company, figure out, look at your event space or look at your product and figure out where can I brand. Where can I put their name on it to create a further experience for them? Or where can I sell? What areas of it can I sell? Like, you see those people that will sell the tattoo space on their forehead. It's funny, but companies, not necessarily saying they look for, you know, to tattoo someone's forehead, but they're always looking for ways that they can, you know, activate their brand further than just like, you know, an ad on a website or a sticker on the side of your truck. They want to be able to kind of further engage their clients and their audience.
Universal Records was a client of yours. They asked you to do something. Can you tell people a little bit about that experience to give them an understanding of just how much branding you do?
For them, we did the whole kickoff for the launch of David Guetta's album. And we've done some other stuff for them since then.
DJ.
Yeah, DJ, the electronica DJ. So I think his CD was called Nothing But the Beat or something like that. So we wrapped four of our carts four of our carts were literally like moving album covers for David Guetta. So they were all wrapped in red, had his face all over it. We branded our popsicles. So we had all red strawberry mojito popsicles for them. I think we did about 3,000 or 4,000 popsicles for them. So they were all red. And then we had David Guetta's face on all of the popsicles as well. All of our staff were dressed in red. All of them had like the David Guetta verbiage. And then they sent us little like earplugs to send over because, of course, it's all about the beat. So don't listen to the lyrics, whatever. But it was fun. So then we went up and down South Beach with the carts and handed out the popsicles. So instead of them just hiring some street team and having the street team go out and hand out the single, it was more of an experience because to food. So if they are something and they're feeling good, they're usually more receptive to kind of hearing what your marketing pitch is after that.
I see. Yeah, right. You walk down the street, someone hands you a popsicle. There's this fun experience. You say, oh, this is great. They're not necessarily trying to sell me anything, but what is that album? Oh, came out with a new album. I might be more likely to listen to it than if someone hands me a CD and says, go put it in your, I don't even know where I would put a CD, actually. not all great, though. You had a bride who wasn't so happy. What did the bride say when she hired you guys?
She just wasn't happy all around. Like we kind of walked into a really weird situation, when we were catering a wedding, and, it was just awful. You know, we definitely experienced the bridezilla at that point and our bridezilla's, catering ice cream for weddings. But, you know, she was awful. She was really awful to my staff. And just complained about everything. She didn't like the way the ice cream looked. She didn't like the flavors, although she picked the flavors. She was upset with the hotel, the W Hotel itself. So it was just a really awkward situation to walk into. Plus, it was also 3 hours later than when we were supposed to serve. So a lot of things went wrong, and we just kind of happened to walk in on a very awkward and bad situation. And I felt really bad for my staff because I was in the back, so they got the blunt force trauma in a way from dealing with her.
So let's get to a couple of things that I mentioned earlier. The first is the reputation. How do you stand out and build this reputation? We know a little bit about the things that you do, like you go to fashion shows even when you're not invited, and you build your brand name there and at special events. Well, what else? How do you raise your profile so high that you get on television and reach a guy who's in a hospital who says, the first thing I do is go and get that popsicle when I'm out of here?
A lot of it is, again, definitely about creating the experience, and then also creating something that's different. You know, we didn't invent popsicles. We definitely didn't invent ice cream. We're not the first ice cream company. We definitely won't be the last, but we pride ourselves on being different, whether it's from the ingredients that we use in our product to, you know, the different things, the different custom things that we do with our product. So
part of it is the flavors of ice cream and the uniqueness of the product. In fact, I'm actually here on my iPad looking at your reviews on Yelp, and people are saying things like pineapple, basil, and coconut pops were so great. And so those aren't the kinds of flavors that you see at your local store.
What else is it?
How do you take that unique product and get people to notice it?
I mean, we don't spend any money on advertising. That's just coming from the industry that we were in. That just became a rule of thumb for us. Mm-hmm. You know, having a unique product makes it something that people want to talk about and kind of take it viral for us in a way. So that really helps. And then we do spend a lot of money on trying to get PR. That has helped us our business tremendously. You know, from being featured on the Today Show and on the Cooking Channel.
So how do you do PR? How do you get that kind of publicity?
I use Haro quite a bit.
Help a reporter out?
That has been great for us. But then also reaching out to a lot of blogs and websites, and just getting them to kind of talk about our story, but then also lending our expertise to them as well. We're just starting to get into Pinterest and being able to kind of use that to help us target more more weddings.
An example of how being on a blog or doing some smaller media helped you get to the bigger media?
A lot of times people ask me, like, oh my gosh, it must have been crazy after being featured on the Today Show. And it was great, but the biggest benefit that we actually got was being featured on, like, Daily Candy, Thrillist, and Urban Daddy. Like, that made our phones ring off the hook. And those are smaller when compared to the Today Show. But the impact, I think, as far as being able to mobilize for sales is much, much greater.
And then once you get in there, is it easier to get to the Today Show?
I think so, because they look at those things when, of course, doing the research about your company. But then those websites always also rank really high in SEO. So when they're Googling, hey, we're looking for a food truck, because that's how the Cooking Channel came up. They were filming about fruit in Florida. And when they Googled, we were one of the first ones to come up. So that's how we came on their radar. But a lot of that is attributed to those kind of websites featuring us, because they rank so high.
I see. All right. So now you get into places like Daily Candy, where you're a natural fit, and they add credibility to you, but you also add credibility to them, because you're the kind of site that they're looking for, or excuse me, you're the kind of product they're looking for. But how do you take that and parlay it into an appearance on the Today Show or mainstream media beyond the search engine optimization, where they suddenly do a search and happen to fall on your site? What do you do to proactively get on there?
I would have to say, yeah, definitely. Once you get that first phone call from them, or even before that, you still have to have all the pieces of the pie put together. And that's just building and, like, running a really good company and having something that is buzzworthy. Because at the end of the day, you know, they want something that is going to appeal to their customer, to their audience base, but then also bring value to their audience base as well. So,
do you have a PR firm that does that?
We don't. We do everything in-house.
You do. And so do you call them up and say, hey, you know, we've been chatting for a while. I want you to know we were in Daily Candy today. If you're looking for somebody to – do you do anything like that?
I haven't, honestly. Okay. I don't know. Sometimes people don't believe me when I say that. I'm like, I've never cold-called any of, like, the big companies. I have sent press releases, or I've sent a little message. Or we've also built some really good relationships with a lot of journalists too. So sometimes when they're working on a story, they'll actually reach out to us, whether we're a fit for it, or we can forward them on to someone that's a fit for it too. That's a lot of what I do now, is when they reach out to me, I'm like, hey, I have a friend that owns a gourmet popsicle company in Philly. I think he would be a great fit for your story. And by being a resource, a lot of it ends up coming back to you in a way as well.
All right. So we talked about a lot of the high points and the challenges that got you there. But let's talk about that time that I was shocked to hear, where you were in bed for a week. Why?
I was really, really depressed. At that time, I had run the business down quite a bit. Almost, I would say, probably close to like $50,000 in debt. It was very, very ugly. And I just didn't know how to recover from that. That coupled with, you know, in the very beginning of the business, when we were buying all this equipment, and not really understanding that although we're in Florida, an ice cream company still is a seasonal business in Florida. So to buy all this equipment and accrue all this debt, and then also be hit with, you know, 3 months of very slow sales. The phone wasn't ringing, people weren't emailing, calling to try and get booked for events was damn near impossible, excuse my language, but, it's Florida cold. So anytime it reaches below like 70 and 65, no one wants to touch anything cold. So I didn't know how to deal with that, because it was very new to me. And I got to a point where I didn't want to do the business anymore. I didn't know how to do the business anymore. I didn't know how to survive. And, you know, I couldn't see the other side of that. I couldn't see, January, the end of January, February, the season would turn back around and then the phone would start ringing off the hook. I couldn't envision that. And I spent about a week, probably a little over a week, just I didn't get out of bed. I didn't leave the house. I didn't want to go on the internet. I didn't want to answer the phone. I was just that depressed because I felt that I had failed. And I felt that I was going to have to close the doors. And it's hard because if I turned on the TV, you saw like Richard Branson or Oprah and they're living like this amazing life. And a lot, that's who you kind of have to look to as the pinnacle of success, because I didn't know a lot of entrepreneurs my age, and I didn't know that what I was going through was really not that big of a deal. At the time, it just seems like such a huge deal to me, and I didn't have anyone else to kind of reference that you're going to go through that a lot.
So how do you get out of that?
You know, definitely, it was a conversation that I had with my dad that really kind of made me get up. And my dad's an entrepreneur. He's had a construction and development company for about 12 or 13 years. And he told me, he's like, Felicia, one time I ran my business into $300,000 in debt. And I was able to get over that by getting up and getting out of bed and going to work the next day and keep working. And he's like, once you run your business into $300,000 in debt, then talk to me about quitting. But he's like, until then, you get your butt up and go sell some ice cream. And that was kind of like the kick in the butt that I needed, because it was someone that was close to me, but it was also someone that made going through a tough time real to me, because it made me no longer feel like I was the only one that had ever been in this situation before. Because a lot of times entrepreneurs, and when you see the Inc. magazines and the entrepreneur magazines, they usually don't tell that story. And I think it's a very big disservice to entrepreneurs that are just starting up to not see the dark days or see when an entrepreneur's account was negative, whatever, or that they thought about, you know, leaving it all because they couldn't afford to go out to lunch with their friends because they had absolutely no money.
You know what? I have a hard time getting entrepreneurs here to talk about that. We spend some time with them before the interviews. I often will do it in the interview and people can watch me struggle. And sometimes I fail at getting them to open up about those deep moments. And sometimes they open up like you did. But you're very comfortable talking about it. Why? Is it because you've done it for so long? Why?
Definitely because I've done it for so long.
And you've talked about this in the past.
Uh-huh.
Yeah. As an entrepreneur, to talk about it so much that you feel comfortable, isn't it hard? Isn't it hard when you have employees to say, hey, I spent a week in bed depressed? Don't you worry that maybe they might see you as someone who could potentially be in bed again for a week, or someone who's not like these people who you talked about who you admire? Sorry, go ahead.
So it happens. Even if you're an entrepreneur, I mean, even if you're an employee, and say something just happens in your life. Hey, your boyfriend breaks up with you. You know, we kind of have this weird timeline, like, hey, you only get 12 days of a year to be depressed in your life. God forbid anything else happen. You know, same thing with entrepreneurs. I don't think that it's fair that a lot of people don't tell that story because...
We're losing the connection here. What you're saying is, as any human being, we entrepreneurs go through those low moments, and there's a certain number of days in our lives where we feel that. For you, it just happened to have gone.
I think they find value in it, honestly. Like, I understand that it could show weakness, but everyone has it, you know? You know, hey, if you're an entrepreneur, if you're an employee and you've had a tough breakup, you know, the way the schedules work and with corporate America, you literally have, what, 10 days of the year to have a bad day. And sometimes, you know, you need more.
All right. So Felicia's internet went down again. It actually went down a few times, as you might have noticed in this interview. Hopefully we'll piece it back together so that it won't be too distracting for you and take away from her story. If you want to follow up with her, check out her website, which I've got up on my screen right here. It's FeliciaHatcher.com, where you can read her blog posts, watch some of her presentations, and find out about her book, which is called How to Start a Business on a Ramen Noodle Budget. Thanks for being a part of Mixergy. Bye.